This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Two-hour chat with Bert Tott over, where he talked me through. I mean, it's, you know, not that I ever need to know why the Beatles are the best band that ever, but he actually gave me precise musical reasons. And you also said the thing that has completely obsessed me ever since.
Tott is here, everybody.
But completely obsessed me ever since. He said nobody can cover the Beatles. They're always shit. Beatle covers are always shit.
Challenge it then.
Okay, I will give you. I'll tell you a good one. The late Fats Domino. There's a version of Everybody's Got Something to Hide Except Me and My Monkey from the White Album by Fats Domino, which the Beatles themselves felt was superior to their own version. I'm just saying.
I think that is brilliant. I didn't know that. But what I mean is, when people do Yesterday, or if they do, you know, I Want to Hold Your Hand, or they do She Loves You, there's some weird reason, which Tott was really interesting about, why there's some sort of weird DNA thing in the Beatles that makes them difficult.
It's the personality that we love. We're in love with the Beatles' personality.
Charisma, as four individuals,
and we love those voices.
And as a group, it's like a guru thing.
They call us white, bearded, and blinkered, but I think we're opening this up. Hello? And welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. We're gathered in a hotel suite just down the Strasse from Berlin Tempelhof, killing time before waiting for the first train out of Mitteleuropa in the morning. The suite is on the tab of Unbound, the website which brings authors and readers together to create something special. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today is Tott Taylor. Tott, hello.
Hello.
Tott is a writer, composer and art curator. He first came to public prominence as head of the Compact organisation. Mm-hmm. Now, those of us of a certain vintage and with fine taste will recognise the Compact organisation as one of the best and most interesting labels of the early 1980s.
Thank you very much. 1981 to 1985.
Right, hooray. And you were saying that it's coming back.
It's coming back with this little thing. I didn't know you were going to say that, but I've got it in my pocket. Werner Lindt, Attention Stockholm.
Attention Stockholm by Werner Lindt.
Yeah. And
look. Oh, great.
It's yours. It's yours, Andy.
Oh, thanks.
It's yours.
What
about that? Live free gift.
Thank you.
Free gift
legally. Thank you so much, Tott. Tott has also, and Tott can just do what he wants now. Tott has curated exhibitions, and he's also the author, according to the script I have in front of me, of a 1,000-word-long debut novel. But I believe it's actually
1,000-page.
I believe it's 1,000-page.
I have in front of me some green.
Yes. And which is published by Unbound. How long does it take you to finish the novel?
It took 12 years to write it, honestly, and it took a year for the copy editor to figure it out. Honestly, it did.
And honestly, it is
the story of John Knightley.
It is. There are two books that I feel at Unbound that we published that I really think add to the growing pool of great fiction. I think The Wake by Paul Kingsnorth is one, and I think Tott's book, The Story of John Knightley, is another. And the fact that people haven't read it is entirely down to the fact that people look at 1,000 pages and think, But you should.
I eagerly await your 1,000-word follow-up.
Do you know what?
And that works for you.
If it was 1,000 words, everyone would have read it.
Thank you, Matt.
We're going to do that version.
But you, Andy, have something to say to me, don't you?
I do indeed. I wonder, have you been reading this week?
I have a fulsome answer for you. I've been reading, as I say, Comfort Read this week. a book that I is one of my very favourite books. I wanted to do it when we did our oral history episode, but I felt we'd had at that stage possibly there had been too many shepherds.
And is this a shepherd book?
This is the memoir. This is the Lifting the Latch, A Life on the Land by Sheila Stewart, based on the life of Mont Abbott of Enston, Oxfordshire, who was a carter and a shepherd. And it is absolutely in the... I don't think there are many... If you want rural first-person singular memoirs, Sheila Stewart's... Obviously, Mont didn't write himself, but he recorded tapes with her, and she's turned this into a truly, in first person, turned it into a wonderful book. Now, the reason I wanted to is the village I live in, Great Chew in Oxfordshire. When I was a student, I used to come up and go to the pub, particularly on a Sunday, because there's a folk night on the Sunday. And there's still a folk night on the Sunday. It's still excellent. But I once saw this man, a very old man, with a lapel, a carnation in his lapel. And it was one of the most incredible... I mean, he had an incredible tenor voice. And he sang, amazing sequence of English folk songs. And he's natty suit, immaculately turned out. And I just remember, I just said, who was that? And they said, oh, that's Mont Abbott. He's from Enston. I said, oh, he's incredible. Is he a singer? No, he's a shepherd. He just lives over. He died in 1986, I think, so before I'd moved to the village. But I gave this book a couple of weeks ago to a friend who lives in the village, who's a stonemason, retired now, and he came to me at the weekend in tears saying, I can't believe I've never read this book before. It's not a complicated book, but it is absolutely the best record. Mont was born in 1902. I'm going to read you a little... there's two. I could read you the bit about when his fiancée dies because she gets caught in a snowdrift and dies of pneumonia. But I think I might just read the end of it because it's written in his voice, and it's a voice that's very familiar because I live in this area. But it's just a brilliant bit of social history. It's an odd thing. I mean, it's not a work of literature in that, you know, you're not going to... Nobody's going to be kind of excerpting it. But what it is a story of complete authenticity. And what Sheila Stewart has done, who is an interesting woman in her own right. I love her biography. She's born illegitimate in 1928. Sheila Stewart counts herself lucky to have been brought up by the Waifs and Strays Society. She became a teacher. And then she specialised in oral histories, basically. I'm not even sure if she's still alive, but if she is still alive, this book has given me more pleasure than many of the great works of literature I've ever read. Mont was kind of, his fiancée died, he then fell down a well. One of the wonderful things in the book is he has a recurring nightmare of falling into a dark hole. And then it happens, and he recovers, and he thinks it's all going to be right. And then the doctor rather cruelly and brutally says to him, he says, you planning to have any babies, Mont? And he says, I'm planning to get married. And this is after his fiancée had been killed, died. I'm planning to have any. He said, well, I'm afraid that ain't going to happen because you're not being able to have children. So it's just a horrible moment in the book where he realized he's fallen into a well and he's hit a bar of metal side saddle. And as he says, back in those days, back now you might have been able to do something, but back then they couldn't. So he said, even if I'd married Kate, I'm thinking of her lying in the ground and I wouldn't have been able to do anything. So, of course, what he becomes is this wonderful... It's honestly, he is everybody's favourite grandfather. The book is full of... It's wise and lovely. And I'll just read you the last bit, which is Mont telling you about... I ain't never been to the pictures. I went once, but I never seed note. It were a Bakshi propaganda picture on by a government during the Great War. I drove a wagonette chock-a-block with Enston folk. When we got to the Odd Fellows Hall and Chippy, it's Chipping Norton, of the famous, you know, set, where it were being showed, there were nowhere left to graze my horses. It'd be too long to leave them standing all that time. I stopped with them and took them cropping along the verge. I ain't never had no holiday, except when I ate my death at Worthing. I don't hanker after flitting abroad and colour telly. I ain't never fled in an aeroplane. Don't want to. Too far to drop. What you never had, you never miss. You've had a hard life, Mont, folks say. Looking back on my career in on the land, carter, shepherd, gardener, I'd be well content. I didn't say I'd enjoyed every minute of it, tent much of a picnic in your lunch in the burrow of a barbed wire fence, but ploughing, penning, planting, I've scratched old England on the back and hers give me wealth untold. Rosa still fetches me every morning, her still won't give I the sack, and sometimes her drives me right round the world, my world, Hanborough, Glimpton, Whiteway Bottom, Peewit Corner, Rollwright's Twins, Neat Enston, Church Enston, Sam Peace, Air Enston, Air Oxfordshire, this England, take a lot of beating. Blessed is the man that stoppeth where he be. I ain't been so well lately. Doctor says I could pop off any day. They asked me if I made a will. I ain't got nothing to will, except this old pocket watch, my shepherd's crook, my folding bar, my wheelbarrow. Them like me now, out of date, antique, ought to be in a museum. They asked me what I'd like to put on my tombstone when I snuffs it. For why? I ain't nobody famous to sign off with a flourish. People just might ask, who were you? Just scratch, Oldmont, Enston, Oxon, England. I reckon that would answer. And that is exactly what he has on his gravestone.
Wow.
It's just it's just a long...
sort of round of applause around the table for that.
It is a sort of classic of its kind. And what she does, which I love, is she doesn't... You know, she it's his voice through the book. It's, yeah. I mean, you really feel a bit overcome now.
I can't follow that.
And the good news is, it's still in print, £8.99, Oxford University Press. It is a sort of a classic of its kind. Lifting the Latch, Sheila Stewart.
Great.
Andy, what have you been reading last year?
Oh, thank you. How did you know? How did you tell? So we're recording this in December 2017.
But.
And I have just finished, a couple of days ago, a book entitled Hearing Secret Harmonies, which is the 12th and final volume of Anthony Pohl's A Dance to the Music of Time. And I have been reading A Dance to the Music of Time all year, one volume a month. I really...
Why are you shaking your head, Matt?
I really... It's been fantastic. It's been one... And I've kept quiet. I've mentioned it a couple of times on here, but I've kept quiet about it because... I'll tell you for why. Because...
Are you writing about it?
Well, sort of. No. What happened was, you may recall that about a year ago, we talked about this before, and I won't dwell on it, but about a year ago, our mutual friend David Miller died. Yeah. And in the last couple of years, particularly, on the occasions that I saw David, he would say to me, have you started reading A Dance to the Music of Time yet? Because it was one of his favourite books. And I hadn't. And so what I decided I would do this year is read the whole thing, one volume a month, as a way of keeping David in mind all year, and it's been really a brilliant experience to read the book. I'm a bit sad now because, having finished it, of course I can't talk to him about it. There's a piece in the TLS this week, there's a review of the new biography of Pohl by Hilary Sperling by A.M. Wilson, in which A.M. Wilson says correctly, who reads A Dance to the Music of Time now? It was considered so important in the era it was published, which was the 50s through to the 1970s. It has fallen from public view somewhat because superficially it seems to be a long, involved chronicle of a particular class in England which has, I suppose, passed from prominence anyway. It's about the upper middle and upper classes.
I've always wanted to do it, and I was kind of inspired by your... I think I'm going to start in January and do next year what you've done this year.
Well,
because I've always wanted to read it, and I've always had that slight suspicion that it is, you know, another bunch of, you know, toffs being, you know, dull.
All I'm going to say about it.
So I'm interested to know whether it transcends its sort of. I mean, somebody said to me, which is very cruel. He said, "Yeah, it's like Woodhouse without the laughs."
Neither fair nor accurate. Erudite but blinkered, I would describe that as.
Sorry, new catchphrase.
I would say the thing that that he has in common with any great writer, and if anything is perhaps somewhat more acute than many great writers, is a terrific comic apprehension of personality and behaviour caused by personality.
Yeah, yeah. So there was was it an Andrew Davis series? Was it adapted?
It was Channel 4, wasn't it? About 20 years ago. Yeah.
And I can remember looking at it and thinking, but you know, it's my problem with that is a bit like I can't abide any of the adaptations of Gatsby. They're just all terrible.
Well, we're going to come on to adaptations, aren't we, later in the episode?
They just all seem to me to be terrible because the joy of Gatsby is in the language.
Well,
and what I feel about Pole is that, or Powell, whatever we're supposed to say, is that he just seems to me to be, and I love the whole story, having read the reviews of the Spurling, is he came to this very late. He was a bit of a, his life was sort of going nowhere, and then he started to do this thing. I'm not sure that it brought him massive wealth or riches, but...
I'm slightly holding back because I think there's a good chance that we might do a poll on Backlisted, and we might even try and do a Dance to Music of Time on Backlisted, because partly for the reason that it was so critically acclaimed in its era and deemed so important and deemed one of the great achievements of post-war English letters, and it's clearly not seen that way anymore. But I also have to say, John, I tried reading this in my 20s
and it didn't work.
Yeah. Coming back to it in my late 40s, it seems so, so different as a reading experience. I'm glad I didn't read it when I was younger. I got so much out of it this year and I've so enjoyed reading it. I'm writing something at the moment about it. Anyway, what I thought I would do is read the beginning of the whole of A Dance to the Music of Time so that... if you, the listener, anyone listening to this podcast in January 2018 has got a head start on A Dance to the Music of Time, you will have inhaled the opening of A Dance to the Music of Time. You will have started reading it almost against your will.
Excellent.
And so you can proceed from there. So I'm just going to read the first couple of paragraphs. I think you will get the feel for it from this alone. One. The men at work at the corner of the street had made a kind of camp for themselves where, marked out by tripods hung with red hurricane lamps, an abyss in the road led down to a network of subterranean drain pipes. Gathered round the bucket of coke that burned in front of the shelter, several figures were swinging arms against bodies and rubbing hands together with large pantomimic gestures, like comedians giving formal expression to the concept of extreme cold. One of them, a spare fellow in blue overalls, taller than the rest, with a jocular demeanour and a long pointed nose like that of a Shakespearean clown, suddenly stepped forward and, as if performing a rite, cast some substance, apparently the remains of two kippers loosely wrapped in newspaper, on the bright coals of the fire, causing flames to leap fiercely upward, smoke curling about in eddies of the northeast wind. As the dark fumes floated above the houses, snow began to fall gently from a dull sky, each flake giving a small hiss as it reached the bucket. The flames died down again, and the men, as if required observance were for the moment at an end, all turned away from the fire, lowering themselves laboriously into the pit or withdrawing to the shadows of their tarpaulin shelter. The grey, undecided flakes continued to come down, though not heavily, while a harsh odour, bitter and gaseous, penetrated the air. The day was drawing in. For some reason, the sight of snow descending on fire always makes me think of the ancient world. Legionaries in sheepskin warming themselves at a brazier. Mountain altars where offerings glow between wintry pillars. Centaurs with torches cantering beside a frozen sea. Scattered, uncoordinated shapes from a fabulous past, infinitely removed from life, and yet bringing with them memories of things real and imagined. These classical projections, and something in the physical attitudes of the men themselves as they turned from the fire, suddenly suggested Poussin's scene in which the seasons, hand in hand and facing outward, tread in rhythm to the notes of the lyre that the winged and naked greybeard plays. The image of time brought thoughts of mortality, of human beings facing outward like the seasons, moving hand in hand in intricate measure, stepping slowly, methodically, sometimes a trifle awkwardly, in evolutions that take recognisable shape, or breaking into seemingly meaningless gyrations, while partners disappear only to reappear again, once more giving pattern to the spectacle, unable to control the melody, unable, perhaps, to control the steps of the dance. Classical associations made me think, too, of days at school, where so many forces, hitherto unfamiliar, had become, in due course, uncompromisingly clear. Now,
come on.
Undecided flakes. That's good.
Some people would say read the whole thing in one go. I really enjoyed taking a break between each volume to let each volume settle.
Yeah.
Then, because Paul wrote each volume a few years apart, you pick up with the characters again several years down the line. And what the book does is tell the story of 60 years of British history and 60 years of the lives of the people. They come and go. They drift in and out of one another's lived experience. So I hope we get to do it on here. And it's great if you were planning to read it.
Well, I just, you know, it's one of the, like Proust, it's one of those things you sort of feel at some point you ought to do. And I've also, I'm fascinated by the period.
Yeah.
I'm really interested, I'm becoming more and more interested in, I think, what that period that between the wars and the I mean, I suppose it's that middle period of the 20th century where it seems that so much of what we're now, the shit that we're now having to clean up, sort of happened between the First World War and the Second World War, and the sort of the post-Second World War, and the, you know, the catastrophic decline of Britain and the end of empire. And I know Paul just seems to me to be a really interesting, if you want to understand Christine Keeler, you know, who died yesterday.
Also, I would add that rather like the Rabbit novels by Updike.
Yeah.
Although, you know, the gap between the first and last volumes is 25 years in terms of when they were written. The final volume particularly does that thing that great fiction does of up until the very last page being both unpredictable and completely satisfying.
Which is great.
It's inconceivable. In fact, when I was just reading that passage, which I know is quite long, but when I was reading that passage with the memory of the final few pages in my mind, it's real spine-tingling stuff.
We'll pick this up again after some adverts. Stay tuned to this.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Talking about unexpected responses to the First World War, I have to say, I think the book that we're about to talk about is one of the oddest and most exotic post-war. I mean, it, you know, there were massive numbers of novels did it, but Lost Horizon.
So it's Lost Horizon. The thing about Lost Horizon, before I ask you, Tot, the question that we tend to ask on this program, I'm going to say a fact about Lost Horizon. I'd heard of Lost Horizon. I'd heard of the concept of Shangri-La. I was surprised to learn that the author of that book had also written another book I'd heard of, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And yet I'm confident that if I went out into the street and said, have you ever heard of James Hilton?
No one would.
To have achieved two of the most culturally significant and best-selling books of the 20th century and yet be forgotten.
It is really odd, isn't it?
Seems to me pure backlisted.
There's three,
stuff.
Really, because Random Harvest as well.
I read Random Harvest this week.
So, three.
Lost Horizon by James Hilton. Tot, when did you first come across this book?
I first came across this book, as usual with me, probably 50% of the books that I've liked I've watched as films, or I've always had a sort of mixture of formats. You know, I'm very interested in if something's a film, can it be a book? If it's a book, can it be a musical? If it's a musical, is it an opera, or is it a sort of Stephen Sondheim thing or whatever it is? And so I think I read the book when I was about 9, because it was one of the few books in our school library, and I probably got about halfway through it and I found it very, very difficult to sort of finish it. And actually I read it again 2 or 3 weeks ago and I found it difficult to finish as well.
A ringing endorsement there.
It was also, I also realised when I was young that it was a sort of thing of wonderment. One of the big things about it was literally the title. I love titles. I'm a big sort of fan of all kinds of titles. And
it's
I love
a great
when you
title.
Get 2 words that take you somewhere. So even if I had never seen the book or read the book, Lost Horizon, you know, as a kid, I don't really know what that means, but I know it's a special thing. And if you then read the book and you find out what it's actually about, the title that comes to you would not be Lost Horizon. It would be something else. So it suggests this person's operating on a kind of a higher plane where they're
really good point. It's thinking, a really odd title.
Yeah, the thinking is like flying above the story, and I like things like this.
Because you would call it, you know, it's essentially the story of Shangri-La.
You might
or
call it Shangri-La. Yeah.
But Lost Horizon is...
bigger.
Mean, Conway, who's the key character in the book, it's all about him losing his bearings.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And before you go any further, Todd, based on something you said to me before we recorded, I'm very keen to go around the table. we have, very unusually for that list, we have a clear split in terms of how we feel about the book. So, John, did you enjoy the book?
No, I did enjoy the book. I mean, I don't think it is a... I don't think it's a massively, you know, it's not Moby Dick. It's not a great work of literature. But I think what I'm curious about is it's a classic high concept book. It kind of sets up a story. In terms of narrative, I think it tells the story quite well. I think there's a little bit of, you know, fudging towards the end.
Matt, did you enjoy the book?
I really enjoyed the book.
Yeah, I mean, enjoyment is exactly what I felt. Okay. I enjoyed it.
I thought it was a very easy read as well.
Yeah,
I thought it was by far
the worst,
the most peculiar book that we have done on that list.
It's peculiar, right. Yeah.
And Todd, what did you say to me? Do you think it's a good book?
I think that, you know, this is what I was about to say, is that at the same time as I was reading it, I used to go to we lived in East Anglia in sort of outskirts of Cambridge, and we had a library, and my mother was a reader, so I used to have to go and get her a book every week from the library, and I picked this one up, and I would have only picked this up because of the cover. That would have been it, really. But at around the same time, I would have seen the black and white film, the Frank Capra film, and I remember when it was at the point when we were watching like Film Matinee and all that stuff, and Fred Astaire films and stuff like that, and this would have really fitted into that. They were black and white, classic Hollywood, like Goldwyn films. And I remember being entranced by the way that it looked. The film looks very, very spectacular. And then I remembered that I'd had the book, and that was the book that I'd probably got halfway through and then abandoned.
Yeah, yeah.
The sort of denouement of the book when they do what they do. I don't know how much to say because I want people to read the book because it is a special story.
It's a bit of a problem for spoilers with this book, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a devastating scene at the end, which I still believe is probably, for me, for my brain, is the most devastating scene in movies. I really think it is. When I see what happens when they get to where they're going, that probably made me levitate on my village sofa, you know.
We should add, this is the 1937 Capra film adaptation starring Ronald Colman, which was in itself a huge
hit
in its day.
And so Capra's reputation, in a way, was made largely on the back of Lost Horizon.
Yeah, well, he had a number of hits, though, you know, when you actually look at the end of it. But like all great things, they can happen at any point in history. It doesn't matter really, you know, when they happen. And this film was, you know, it is a very much a 1930s film.
I mean, if you're going to ask me about the book again, Andy, I would say, do I prefer... the film is a better work of art than the book.
I think the film is better than the book.
Yeah.
I
think you'd be quite an odd person not. But I'm interested about the book because I wonder if Tibetan Buddhism, if that kind of mystical stuff, the Shangri-La stuff, that's now very familiar post-60s when it became, you know, I wonder if anybody had. I mean, you know, it's quite a deep book. There's a lot of philosophical, complicated stuff in there, which for a popular potboiler is quite. I mean, it's not what you're getting in
well,
most.
This is a recording of James Hilton. This is him in 1949. Talking about the inspiration of Lost Horizon.
Because this book was written in 1933,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So let's listen to that now.
Lost Horizon was written in London 18 years ago during the winter of 1932. That was a hard winter for the world. The lowest point had we then known it of the Depression, and already dark with the threat of war to come. About that time, it probably began to dawn on civilized man that he lived in an age of recurrent and deepening crisis. That military victories did not bring peace, that his world wars would have to be given numbers, and that nowhere on earth was there any place where the storm could be outridden. It was in this mood that I wrote Lost Horizon, and I enjoyed writing it as one may sometimes almost consciously enjoy a dream. I once met another traveler from Tibet, a rather odd fellow he was, and he assured me that he had actually found the lost valley of Shangri-La that I wrote about, a haven of peace and beauty hidden amidst the highest peaks in the world, and that it was all pretty much as I had described it. Of course, I can hardly believe that, but I should like to. I should like to.
Oh, that's great.
That's nice.
That is lovely.
But your point, John, about what this book said, why some books resonate in the way they
and this
do.
Was a
what
massive bestseller.
A bestseller,
a massive bestseller.
This one of the reasons this was such a bestseller is that it was. You're gonna have to cut this, Matt.
The first pocketbook.
One of the reasons this was such a bestseller is that it was the first
pocketbook,
the first mass market paperback
in America, 7 million copies.
It's one of the best-selling books of the 20th century. Incredible. For that reason. I've got here the list of the first 10 pocketbooks, which I thought I would share with
you.
So, Lost Horizon by James Hilton. And remember, these all sold millions of copies because the Pocket got the idea from Penguin in the UK.
I'm depressed already.
Here we go. Right, these all sold millions of copies. Lost Horizon. 2, Wake Up and Live by Dorothea Brand. 3, 5 Great Tragedies by William Shakespeare.
Yes.
4, Topper by Thorne Smith. That's what we should be doing on this show. Topper.
Any Topper fans out there, come on down.
5, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie. 6, Enough Rope by Dorothy Parker. 7, Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, which became a bestseller in the US in the 1930s for the first time. Amazing. 8, The Way of All Flesh by Samuel Butler.
Wow.
9, The Bridge of San Luis Rey by Thornton Wilder. Well, and 10, Bambi by Felix Salten.
Wow.
So it has that tremendous. The reason why it became so popular in the mid 1930s is that Hilton had already. His first hit is actually Goodbye, Mr. Chips. And then on the back of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, Lost Horizon becomes a mass bestseller too. So he's clearly telling stories that people in the 30s want to hear.
I was thinking as I was reading it that the lamasery of Shangri-La is a little bit like your kind of fantasy English public school. It's sort of...
It's an enclosed kind of community.
Enclosed community, hierarchical... That it's inductive. You don't, you know, Conway, who is the kind of the main character. He doesn't. The only way you learn stuff is by asking questions and listening. It's not by. It's a novel that really does. I mean, I do think it's a novel that makes you think and reflect.
It's very deep. Yeah.
Todd, would you read us
extract from the novel so we can get a feel for it?
Well, we haven't really said what it's actually about yet.
Yeah, do that.
Perhaps we should do that. So why don't I read from this epic little publication that I bought a long time ago, Cliff Notes.
You can actually
get lost horizing Cliff Notes. No, but this is very good
and where did that Cliff Notes come from?
This came from the girls.
I have to say, Totter's got CDs. He's got amazing. Everything. He's got R.D. Lang's Knots. He's got very amazing. Relevant. He's got amazing older editions of the book. It's very well prepared, and all these incredible LPs, which we're unfortunately not going to be able to play because we don't have any.
I'm going to spin them around on my teeth at the end. You don't know that yet. But there we are. Look, the English department, Highland Park High School, Los Angeles, California. That's where this came from. It was probably about 1973. In fact, it must be, because at the start, it says also by James Hilton, Random Harvest. And it says here, we've got a printing. What does it say? First printing, 1933. And it says 1973, 17th printing. That's pretty good to get to 17.
Have you got the Cliff Notes?
I've got the Cliff Notes. This is what they say. And just to say that the book's quite different to the film, because the book has a lot of unresolved things in it, which makes it a little bit difficult to get, particularly with this prologue and epilogue in it, which the film sort of dispenses with in a way. So here we are. Two men, a novelist and a neurologist, sit up all night discussing the fate of a school acquaintance. This is Hugh Conway, the star of the book, the lead character. The brilliant British consul who mysteriously disappeared the year before, 1930, during an uprising in Afghanistan. A plane carrying him and three other passengers was stolen by an unidentified man, and the whole party was never heard of again. The author, Rutherford, discloses the startling information that he had found Conway quite by chance, ill and suffering from amnesia in a Chinese mission 3 months before. While Conway was on his way back to England with Rutherford, his memory returned, and he described his fantastic adventures to Rutherford, who subsequently put them in manuscript form. Conway disappeared from the boat in Honolulu, and his last words sent in a letter to Rutherford 3 months later from Bangkok stated that he was starting on a long journey to the northwest. Rutherford sets out to look for him. Now, that, weirdly enough, is the Cliff Notes prologue. Now, if I had read that and you'd read the book, you'd kind of go, where is that? What's actually happening? But that is what happens. But simply, what actually happens is that there is a revolution in Iran, and Hugh Conway is the British consul, and he manages to get a group of people who are frightened out of the way on an airstrip, and they jump into a plane where they don't know where they're going, and Conway kind of gets, get us out of here. And the plane's got a Chinese pilot, and they go, they don't know where, but they go into the Himalayas, and they crash somewhere. This is a, I'm cutting it all down. And in the morning, when they all think, you know, are we going to die, it's very cold, and they're in the middle of this kind of mountain, some monks come down from a passage, from a sort of light passage, onto a ledge, and they come and they look at the plane, and the people in the plane think, oh my God, we're really in trouble here. And the head monk, who is in what we're going to talk about next, John Gielgud, speaks with a kind of perfect English accent and asks them who they are and if they would like to go with them back to their village. And that's where the story starts.
Now, I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning of the book. This is the part that we were talking about that's narrated by Rutherford.
Yeah.
And this is the scene. This, I think, is actually... it's my favourite scene in the book. And it is an example of master storytelling. So here we go. A rather odd thing was beginning to happen. Conway had sat down at the keyboard and was playing some rapid, lively piece that I didn't recognise, but which drew Siver King back in great excitement to ask what it was. Conway, after a long and rather strange silence, could only reply that he didn't know. Siver King exclaimed that that was incredible and grew more excited still. Conway then made what appeared to be a tremendous physical and mental effort to remember and said at last that the thing was a Chopin study. I didn't think myself it could be, and I wasn't surprised when Siver King denied it absolutely. Conway, however, grew suddenly quite indignant about the matter, which startled me, because up to then he had shown so little emotion about anything. "My dear fellow," Seaver King remonstrated, "I know everything of Chopin's that exists, and I can assure you that he never wrote what you have just played. He might well have done so, because it's utterly in his style, but he just didn't. I challenge you to show me the score in any of the editions." To which Conway replied at length, "Oh yes, I remember now. It was never printed. I only know it myself from meeting a man who used to be one of Chopin's pupils. Here's another unpublished thing I learned from him." Rutherford steadied me with his eyes as he went on. "I don't know if you're a musician, but even if you're not, I dare say you'll be able to imagine something of Seaver King's excitement and mine too, as Conway continued to play. To me, of course, it was a sudden and quite mystifying glimpse into his past, the first clue of any kind that had escaped. Seaver King was naturally engrossed in the musical problem, which was perplexing enough, as you'll realise when I remind you that Chopin died in 1849. I mean, it's wonderful, but it's
setup.
Such a brilliant setup. Such a way of showing, not telling.
And actually, I found there's a lot in the book that is like that. There's a lot of quite interesting philosophical digression in it. This is just a good little passage of great description. "That evening after dinner, Conway made occasion to leave the others and stroll out into the calm, moon-washed courtyards. Shangri-La was lovely then, touched with the mystery that lies at the core of all loveliness. The air was cold and still. The mighty spire of Caracal looked nearer, much nearer than by daylight. Conway was physically happy, emotionally satisfied, and mentally at ease, but in his intellect, which was not quite the same thing as mind, there was a little stir. He was puzzled. The line of secrecy that he'd begun to map out grew sharper, but only to reveal an inscrutable background. The whole amazing series of events that had happened to him and his three chance companions swung now into a sort of focus. He could not yet understand them, but he believed they were somehow to be understood." And that sort of reflective tone is very much what the book's like. It's a lot of Conway being kind of initiated into the mysteries of this extraordinary place.
Yeah.
And without giving too much away, you know, it's, as Andy said, there is a sort of, you know, there is a kind of a MacGuffin-y type plot to it as well. But I have to say, I'm still not sure what the fuck goes on in the book.
My question to you, Todd, is a straightforward one. What is this book about?
Well, it's about wonder. It's about aging. It's about us being different personalities as we go through our lives. I reckon we're about six different people when we get from A to B. It's about a single person and the way that he is thought of by the people in a particular group. It's a group story. And John has alluded to some kind of philosophical, you know, maybe hippie sort of spirit, and I totally agree with that, and I've got some ideas about where it actually comes from, because this book does sort of come out of the blue.
I was absolutely, when I was a teenager, I loved Lobsang Rampa, which was it turns out he was a plumber from Bristol, but those books were all about, I grew up in a lamasery in Tibet, and the whole Tibetan Buddhism thing and Lhasa what I feel now is that, what's his name, I can't remember, he's got a great name, he's called Bill someone, but he was, you know, Tuesday Lobsang Rampa was his, and he was the reincarnation of a Tibetan Lama. But I obviously think he read Lost Horizon an early age. And I mean, it's quite interesting, because you do have to keep reminding yourself that this book was written in 1933.
Yeah.
It was, as Hilton himself said, it was at the sort of the bottoming out of the Depression. It was before the Second World War.
Yeah.
It was before Hiroshima. And way before Tibetan Buddhism became a kind of a... I mean, I guess there were elements of it in there. Aldous Huxley was interested in it, but it certainly wasn't mainstream.
Well, hang on.
There are
Well, no, I think what you're saying, John, Todd as well, is for me what the book is about is, let's say you find a utopia, is it possible to sustain a utopia? Mm. The idea, or is it something that you have to look for and leave? Well, somebody in the 1930s who had been through the First World War with an eye on what might happen in the future seems to me...
I mean, without giving away the differences between the book and the film, which we're all a bit kind of... is the book is very much less clear about what happens. Mm.
It's unresolved.
Yeah, it's unresolved in the book in a way.
Can I just pick up on what you said originally? Because I think that's a key thing. So I think that the influence in this book could very well be... So it was written in London... It wasn't written in America. He hadn't gone there yet. And I think that it comes from, number one, possibly William Morris, News from Nowhere.
News from Nowhere.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly what it reminded me of.
Because if you think about hippie
not communes, a very good book, in my view. I mean, much as I love, I adore Morris. But it is
the kind of first one of its type. If you think about hippie communities, you know, William Morris is like the first thing, really. And that's 1892. It says here, I just looked at it this morning to have a look at it, it says, no one unburdened with very heavy anxieties could have felt otherwise than happy that morning. And it must be said that whatever anxieties might lie beneath the surface of things, we didn't seem to come across any of them. Now, one of the ideas about Shangri-La is that you can actually stay much younger than you are, as long as you don't have anxieties. And that's why they have the Tangetsu berry or whatever it's called.
Oh, that's
you
know, that's the right, the magic narcotic berry.
Yeah, narcotic berry. Brilliant. And the idea is
there is a slight magic boost thing about it. Magic boost thing about it as well, isn't it? It's like, open the door.
But the thing is, it's so what's so interesting about it is that it's so embedded in the culture of the whole 20th century,
it is,
the
really.
Notion of Shangri-La. Now, we have another clip here, which I was so happy when I found this. So Hilton is writing about utopia, but here he is talking about another writer in another book which portrays the opposite, portrays dystopia.
George Orwell is a distinguished English writer who is desperately concerned, as many others of us are today, with the shape of things to come. And as long ago as 1932, Mr. Huxley satirized the regimented state in his book called Brave New World. Indeed, the crisis of our civilization is in some danger of becoming a cliché for after-dinner speakers. Personally, I find Mr. Orwell's picture horrible and timely and fascinating. It will probably take its place among the memorable works of its kind, both for its technical virtuosity and for a sort of intellectual passion that pervades it throughout. Mr. Orwell is, as we say, burned up about the state of the world, but the fuel of that fire is not only in the world, but in his own mind. This is what makes the satirist at all times and in all ages. And it's why, having read Mr. Orwell's 1984, you may not feel you'd like to meet any of its characters, but you do feel you'd like to meet Mr. Orwell, if only for an argument.
1949.
That's incredible.
So Hilton was born in 1900, and he wrote 20 novels.
Yeah.
1920 novels. has his first success in the early 1930s, and then he moves to Hollywood, and he works in Hollywood as many writers did in that time. He won an Oscar for his contributions to the script of Mrs. Miniver. He contributes to Foreign Correspondent by Alfred Hitchcock. And then he sort of becomes, towards the end of his life, what you're hearing then is he used to regularly broadcast on books for NBC. Mm. So those clips come from him as a kind of Hollywood personality writer. Mm. One of his great public admirers was Sigmund Freud, although Freud thought that he had been too prolific. perhaps
the curse of the middle brand.
But he wrote a book. I'd love to read. There's a book of his. This description sounds amazing. This is from the late. This is from the 40s, I think. He wrote a novel called We Are Not Alone, and I'm quoting from the description here: a grim story of a legally approved lynching brought on by wartime hysteria in Britain.
Wow.
Now that sounds like
that sounds great,
doesn't it? Yeah.
I mean, he's a master storyteller. He's a good storyteller, you have to say. I think Lost Horizon is I mean, it's fascinating because it obviously, it. I mean, you know, put pocketbooks aside, it touched a nerve. I mean, you don't sell. I mean, it even in the 70s, it sold 3 million copies by the 70s. God knows what it sold.
Yeah,
but it's a proper sort of blockbuster. So what could possibly go wrong? And a great
okay,
film.
So...
What could possibly okay, go
so,
wrong?
So Todd and I were talking about this. So Hilton has this incredible weird thing that happens twice to him. He's got a hugely successful book, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Lost Horizon. It becomes a great black and white film, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Lost Horizon.
Robert, don't
then becomes
him.
A terrible musical, Goodbye Mr. Chips, Lost Horizon. So Goodbye Mr. Chips is made into a musical in the late 1960s with songs by Leslie Bricusse.
Yep.
Starring Peter O'Toole, the worst bits
of casting
of all time.
Remember, of course,
yeah, okay.
Now I do remember.
And then, but this is what, Tot, tell us something about the musical adaptation of Lost Horizon.
Okay, I really like it. I don't think it's bad or silly or anything. As a film, it's a bit strange, I guess. When it came out in 1973, I actually went to see it three times that week with my friend Mick Bass, who's a songwriter as well. And we went to see it just to hear the songs come up. Because in my view, this is actually, is Burt Bacharach and Hal David, and it's them at the height of their powers.
You think this is Bacharach and David at their absolute...
Absolutely.
I had never heard this soundtrack until about 10 days ago. I've now listened to the soundtrack several times and I've seen the film. And I have to say, the soundtrack is magnificent,
yes.
I think. Yes. So thank you, Todd, for making... I bought the record years ago, but because of its reputation, I'd never actually played it. You really rate it, don't you?
I think it's very beautiful, and I think it's very interesting as well. There is some synchronicity with this hippie thing, and of course we are now in the hippie era, and so Lost Horizon is very appropriate. But also, Bacharach David had at least... 7-8 years of being like the top team, maybe apart from Lennon McCartney. And I think that they wanted to move somewhere else, they wanted to move into another area, and this sort of oriental, slightly kind of Chinese thing, that bit that you played there's not very representative.
But it sounds like a
Bacharach. It's got the Latin flavour. Also, at the time, if you think about what was actually happening, you know, 70, 71, 72, 73, we were talking about it before, you've got Stephen Sondheim Company, you know, it's the height of sophistication of songwriting and putting that together with a story.
Yeah.
And I believe that this is as well. You have Jimmy Webb, you know, you have this thing where Surf's Up, you know, you have things where pop music is at its most sophisticated level. It's very, very chromatic. It's modulating all the time. You know, you get like a line with four, you're in four keys in a Jimmy Webb song, for example. Surf's Up, it's difficult to figure out where you actually are. And there's a song here called The World is a Circle, where I counted it in 9 seconds, we're in four different keys.
The thing about The World is a Circle is, a Todd pointed out to me, to my utter rapture, that The World is a Circle sounds remarkably like a highly orchestrated version of our usual backlisted theme music.
So what
you heard at the beginning of this episode, I hope, Matt, is a little bit of the extract from The World is a Circle, which just sounds like our music, but wonderfully orchestrated.
Yeah.
The score is amazing.
Amazing.
But there are big problems with the film. I've seen the film now. Now listen, we're going to play a bit from a song. This is a key song in the musical adaptation called If I Could Go Back, where Conway, the character of Conway, played by Peter Finch, immediately the red light starts flashing. What could go wrong? But Conway, played by Peter Finch...
He's got to be way too old. Right, I mean, he's way too old.
He's thinking to himself... If I could go back to civilization from Shangri-La, would I go back?
Okay.
Now, here is this. I also, in preparation for this episode, I read, although I have had a copy for several years, I read Burt Bacharach's autobiography.
Great.
It was wonderful.
Great.
Well, the least gallant book ever written. That's not the bit I'm going to. So I'm going to read you this. This is from the chapter about Lost Horizon. And this is what he talks about, that song that we've just listened to. I won't do Bert's voice because it's not
Bert's
fair. But
voice.
I'll do. Although I still think a lot of the music I did for Lost Horizon was good, there was one scene in the picture where Peter Finch, who played the leader of the Travellers, has to make a big decision. He misses his life in London, but if he stays in Shangri-La, he can be with the woman he loves forever. So he sings, "If I Could Go Back." The song had a lot of heart, and I thought it was very powerful. When I saw the song in the rushes, I thought it was good. But after I watched a rough cut of the entire film for the first time, I knew it was a disaster. It didn't matter that Peter Finch was singing, "How do I know this is part of my real life? If there's no pain, can I be sure that I feel life? And would I go back if I knew how to go back?" Because when you saw it in the movie, you didn't give a fuck if he went back or not.
So this film is a, you know, which was known as in the Hollywood community as lost investment.
Yeah.
It destroyed.
Tell us about what happened to Bacharach after this film.
Well, you know, the partnership between Bacharach and Hal David split up.
Bacharach sort of doesn't do much
well,
for a long time.
Well, he goes and makes these couple of records that I bought, including he makes a version of, I mean, this is, he didn't, you know, it's not that he didn't like the songs from Lost Horizon, because he goes off and makes an album of them himself. There it is, Living Together. And that's actually very, very beautiful, even if the film didn't exist. And then this one, Futures, which is again another advance, that's 1977. So he's still kind of active, but I think they definitely kind of lost the gist of it. But actually, in truth, if you look at the history of Bacharach and David, they'd lost the gist about a couple of years before. They'd had some wonderful singles with Dionne Warwick that didn't actually make it, and that must have been desperately disappointing after that very long run, you know, and all great songwriting runs come to an end. They just do.
I'd love you to do another, if you've got anything else to read from the book.
Yeah, read us something from the book, Tom.
Because, what I feel is that this is a classic example of a narrative that sort of, if it hadn't existed, somebody would have had to have invented it. I read it with a sense of familiarity, which was quite odd. I mean, you know, I've never read it before. I never really thought about James Hilton as a writer before. I mean, it's not massively similar to Mr. Chips, but there are sort of themes there. And I think, I don't know, I sort of think the whole idea of there's a brilliant passage where he predicts the Second World War and says, you know, there's a major and as you heard from that clip of him talking, you know, the world wars being numbered. There is a sense, I can see that it has that sort of slightly creepy quality that people think, yes, you know, maybe there is this idea of living in a place where, I mean, there's a couple of things I marked out where you've got time to do and to learn and to expand and this marvellous kind of, and the whole idea of Shangri-La. I mean, as far as I can see, this is where the whole Shangri-La, which is now hotels and everywhere you go in the world, there are Shangri-Las. This is the Fons et Origo of the concept.
Well, here's one.
Blinkered but erudite. This is the Fons et Origo of Shangri-La. I mean, this is where Shangri-La comes from.
Well.
And then when you look on the internet, there's Shangri-Las everywhere.
Camp David, which is the president of the United States Country House, was originally called Shangri-La because of this.
That's a good fact.
And then it became a
chunky bit of 20th century popular culture.
Well, Todd, please read us something to take us out.
Read us out.
So when Conway arrives at Shangri-La, we learn how Shangri-La came to be, and it was because a Capuchin monk went there. We find out later on that was a couple of hundred years ago, which is kind of an odd thing. And he was Father Perrault, and he'd been ill, and he went there to get healed, etc. And this is a little bit, just one paragraph really, but it just sort of typifies the style of writing and some information about Father Perrault, who is then the sort of grand master that Conway then goes to see towards the end of the book to kind of get information about what happens. And again, it's very difficult to tell people the story because it's going to the story advances every couple of pages, it's going to spoil it. Now let me tell you about this man. His name was Perrault, and he was by birth a Luxembourger, it says. Before devoting himself to Far Eastern missions, he'd studied at Paris and other universities. He was something of a scholar. There are few existing records of his early life, but it was not in any way unusual for one of his age and profession. He was fond of music and the arts. He had a special aptitude for languages. And before he was sure of his vocation, he had tasted all the familiar pleasures of the world. So the idea being that you can actually be, very fulfilled and still quite unhappy and needing something else. So it's got this emptiness at the centre of it.
Mm. There's one little tiny bit which I thought is quite nice, is Conway, and this the link with the First World War, which I like. There came a time, he realised, when the strangeness of everything made it increasingly difficult to realise the strangeness of anything. When one took things for granted merely because astonishment would have been as tedious for oneself as for others. Thus far had he progressed at Shangri-La, and he had remembered that he'd attained a similar, though far less pleasant, equanimity during his years at the war. Which I think is kind of, it's that, the whole point about the book is that Conway, who gets fitted up to become this mystic in the book, is sort of fitted up because he's been through the horror of the First World War. And that whole sense, which is a big cliche now, detachment, which, you know, the idea is, you know, the laziness in doing stupid things can be a great virtue, is one of the lines I love. But this idea that you don't attach yourself. Conway drives everybody mad by saying, hey, yeah, it's all right, I'm kind of here, I'm quite enjoying myself. But it becomes a sort of a philosophical virtue by the end of the book. I think it's, like I say, I don't think it is a towering masterpiece of a novel, but I think it's fascinating that it was as successful as
it
was.
But it has that thing. It's one of the great gifts of fiction that I read it. I thought, what a peculiar book. Look at the problems there. What are that lumpy bit? That bit. Can I get it out of my head? Of course I can't. As you know, it really resonates. So, Todd, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for giving us, also, giving me the excuse to spend literally weeks listening to background music.
And there's nothing better than... I remember you said it, there's nothing better than background and David when they're on.
Yeah, yeah. No.
On song.
Yeah.
Oh, that seems as good a point as any. Thanks to Top Taylor, to our producer Matt Hall, and thanks again to our sponsors Unbound. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at BacklistedPod, or on Facebook, obviously, BacklistedPod, and now on our lovely, beautiful new page on the Unbound website, on Boundless, Unbound's new and very delightful online magazine, unbound.com/boundless/backlisted. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another show in a fortnight.
You can choose to listen to Backlisted with or without adverts. If you prefer to listen to it without adverts, you can join us on our Patreon at patreon.com/backlisted, where you also get bonus content of 2 episodes of Locklisted, the podcast where we talk about the books and films and music that we've been listening to over the last couple of weeks. You can